This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Crimea prepares for a referendum. The clock is ticking as nations search for a missing Malaysian plane. The European Union foreign policy chief meets on Iran's nuclear program. Increasingly, French Jews are opting for burial in Israel and working to increase opportunities for women around the world.
When you know there are many opportunities, but you know you can't have access to them, that's the worst.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The chief of Crimea's election commission said today he is moving ahead with preparations for next Sunday's referendum on unification with Russia. He said all registered Crimean voters are eligible to vote. Russian forces have tightened their grip on Crimea as authorities in the breakaway territory push their plan to join Moscow. Ukraine's interim prime minister vowed Sunday not to give up a single centimeter of territory. Arseniy Yatsenyuk addressed supporters who rallied in Kiev to celebrate the 200th birthday of a Ukrainian poet and national hero, Taras Shevchenko.
This is our land. Our parents and grandparents spilled their blood for this land. We will not give up a single centimeter of Ukrainian land. Let Russia and the Russian president know this.
Mr. Yatsenyuk is to meet Wednesday with U.S. President Barack Obama in Washington to discuss the standoff over Crimea, a strategic peninsula in southern Ukraine, with a Russian-speaking majority. A Russian lawmaker said the Kremlin had set aside $1.1 billion to rebuild Crimea's industrial infrastructure if the disputed region votes to join Russia. German Chancellor Angela Merkel told Russian President Vladimir Putin in a phone call Sunday the planned referendum is illegal and violates Ukraine's constitution. Mr. Putin defended the separatist drive in Crimea as consistent with international law, and a regional leader said Ukrainian troops remaining there should leave the territory unless they renounce their loyalty to Kiev. U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Tony Blinken says Washington will not recognize the annexation of Crimea by Russia if residents of the region vote to leave Ukraine. Former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul told VOA the annexation will isolate Russia from the rest of the world for years to come, maybe even decades to come. He said even the Chinese are not supporting Russia in this act. Nobody thinks this act is legitimate. Russian forces tightened their grip on the peninsula, taking over a Ukrainian border post on the western edge of Crimea, trapping about 30 personnel inside. A Ukrainian military spokesman said Russian forces now control 11 border guard posts across the territory. For some perspective on Russia's involvement in Ukraine, VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with two scholars on the region. Matthew Rozhansky is director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, and Andrew Cushions is director of the Russian and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Rozhansky was asked for his read on why Russian President Putin sent troops into Crimea.
I think there are several layers of interest here from the Russian side. First and foremost, obviously, is Ukraine. You can't separate the events in Crimea in the last week from the larger story, which is that Ukraine's now had a revolution. It turned out to be a violent revolution. It turned out to be quite a significant change. You had, obviously, President Yanukovych fleeing the country and being replaced by what had before then been the opposition, as opposed to the kind of middle ground constitutional transfer of power that was envisioned in the EU brokered negotiations. Under those circumstances, I think there's a real concern from Moscow that they will have lost their ability to leverage into Ukrainian politics. And so this is a strong signal to the Ukrainians going forward. Hey, look, we need to be taken seriously. We want to continue to be able to effectively veto Ukraine's path in joining the European Association Agreement, potentially in the future joining the EU, certainly joining NATO, which has been a big Russian concern for a long time. There's also a major Russian domestic political factor here, which is that it is absolutely true. Russians and Ukrainians are historically close to each other. The two societies read each other's media. They're both very large Eastern Slavic countries. And of course, Putin asserts a kind of leadership over East Slavs, more than just Russians. The Ukrainian church is very important to his image in that respect. And his concern, I think, is, so here you've had a major popular uprising, which has deposed a leader who seemed in many respects to be following Putin's model a power vertical, agglomerating assets around himself, using authoritarian means, ultimately using violence against the protesters. Well, if they can succeed in Ukraine, then the question that many in Russia have raised is, why not in Russia as well? And I think that's a bridge too far for Putin. He cannot accept that.
Turning to you, Andrew Cutchins, to get your take on what is motivating Vladimir Putin. No question, Ukraine is critical to its identity. It's a country that bridges both the East and the West. I'd like to get your take on the fact that he has gone this far and what else is at stake.
Well, let me put it in a little more colloquial terms, perhaps. Putin is really mad.
Okay. That's an understatement.
He was really mad that the February 21 agreement fell apart.
This was the agreement that the EU and
EU
the Russians and
the Americans
brokered.
The Russians observed. The Russians did not sign on to it. But in retrospect, they've seen that as kind of the status quo they want to get back to. But that's absolutely impossible. Anybody who looked at the February agreement should have understood, though, there was virtually no chance that Ukrainian people would accept it, that Yanukovych could not stay in power for another 10 months until December. You know, I think that Matt nicely laid out some of the motivations behind Mr. Putin. But I think his great miscalculation is that if he does indeed view himself as the leader of the so-called East Slavs, I really don't think that most of the East Slavs outside of the Russian Federation look to Vladimir Putin as their leader. And if there's any silver lining that has emerged out of what's taken place in the last week, is that the Ukrainians living in the East and the Ukrainians living in the South, where there is a higher percentage relatively than in the west of Ukraine, but still a minority ethnic Russian population in Ukraine, they are much more united today than they were a week ago. And in that respect, Putin may very well find himself that, yes, he will have Crimea, whether it's in a kind of a de facto independence like Abkhazia, or actually joining the Russian Federation, but he will have aided and abetted, I think, a much deeper antagonism more broadly in Ukraine against Russia. I think it's unfortunate in general because Ukraine is a country with some identity challenges because of the East-West split. It's a little bit too simplistic, but I think that Putin, if his goal was to try to send a signal to Kyiv and the Ukrainian government, I think it was deeply counterproductive for his interests in the long term, but time will tell.
Andrew Cutchin is director of the Russia and Eurasian Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Matthew Rozhansky, director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, spoke with Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program Encounter. For more of their conversation, go to our website, voanews.com, and look for Encounter under podcasts. Eight countries have joined the search for the Malaysia Airlines flight that went missing early Saturday. But so far, no positive sightings of the jetliner have been made. Marion Brown reports from Hanoi.
It's day three of the search for Malaysia Airlines flight MH370, vanished over waters between Vietnam and Malaysia early Saturday morning. Malaysia's Department of Civil Aviation says eight nations have a combined 40 ships and 34 aircraft involved in the hunt for the plane. Several sightings of several suspicious objects were reported Saturday and Sunday, including what was believed to be a window or door of the plane. But Azrahuddin Abdul Rahman, Director General of Malaysia's Department of Civil Aviation, said Monday that nothing has been verified.
Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, we have not found anything that appears to be objects from the aircraft, let alone the aircraft. We will be intensifying our efforts to locate the missing aircraft.
He said some samples of an oil slick spotted in the area are being analysed to see if they could have come from the aircraft. But Azrahuddin said the fate of the aircraft remains unknown.
And as far as we are concerned, we are equally puzzled as well. The Honourable Prime Minister used the word perplexing. We are equally puzzled as well. And to be confirmed what really happened on that particular day on this ill-fated aircraft, we need hard evidence. We need concrete evidence. We need parts of the aircraft.
The jetliner was carrying 239 people, more than 150 of whom were Chinese nationals. China has sent 4 search and rescue vessels and 2 warships to help in the mission. Vietnam has dispatched 2 planes and 7 ships to search for the plane, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs said in a statement Monday. The National Committee for Search and Rescue said another 5 planes and 4 ships are on standby for search activities. Greg Waldron, Asia Managing Editor of Flight Global, a trade publication for the aviation sector, said he thought the coordination of search and rescue vessels was coming together as an international team effort. He said the challenge is spotting pieces of wreckage.
The wreckage is very unlikely to show up on radar, and since it's also very unlikely to show up on infrared because it's the same temperature as the surface. So in terms of finding pieces of the aircraft, if indeed these pieces of the aircraft are floating around in the sea, you're really relying on people's eyeballs. And also the wreckage, if there is wreckage in the ocean, has had days to spread, and this could make it more challenging to locate.
The United States sent the USS Pinckney, an Arleigh Burke-class guided missile destroyer, to the area on Sunday. Another vessel is on its way, says Blue Moore, spokesman for the 7th Fleet Public Affairs Office.
Yes, we're also sending the USNS Erickson. It's on the way there. It's not in the same body of water, but it's on the way there.
He said the biggest challenge is time. As the more time passes, the less chance there is to save lives. It could be a long wait before answers are found. When an Air France jetliner disappeared over the Atlantic on its way from Rio de Janeiro to Paris in 2009, it took investigators nearly 2 years to find and retrieve the aircraft's black box data recorders. This is Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton met Sunday in Tehran with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif to talk about the negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. Ms. Ashton spoke to reporters about the temporary deal between Iran and Western powers, which contend Iran is developing nuclear weapons.
I think this interim agreement is really, really important, but not as important as the comprehensive agreement that we are currently engaged in. Difficult, challenging, there's no guarantee we'll succeed, but I think it's very important with the support of the people of Iran for the work that is going on by the minister and his team, and with the support of the international community for my work, that we should aim to try and succeed.
Mr. Zarif reiterated Iran's intentions regarding nuclear weapons.
Iran will only accept a solution that is respectful, that respects the rights of the Iranian people, and at the same time, Iran finds it in its own interest to make sure that there are no ambiguities about Iran's intentions, because we have no intention to seek nuclear weapons.
Under an interim deal reached in November, Iran agreed to limit uranium enrichment for 6 months in return for an easing of Western sanctions that have crippled the Iranian economy. The deal took effect January 20th. France is Europe's largest Jewish population, but many do not want to stay there forever. The last decade has seen a steady rise in the number of French Jews opting for burial in Israel. The reasons are many, but one of the biggest factors is space. In some French cemeteries, Jewish-only burial sections are rapidly filling up. Lisa Bryant has the story from Paris.
Bonjour, bienvenue.
Bonjour, merci.
Merci à vous, merci.
Frank Darmon is only 35, but he already knows where his bones will lie, not in his native France, but in Israel.
Quand vous regardez, vous allez dans un cimetière en Israël et vous... Vous regardez le ciel bleu, le soleil, tous ces tons blancs.
He says that when you compare a cemetery in Israel with the blue sky, the sun, and the white tombstones, with one in France with its gray surroundings, it's very distressing. The soul does not have the same type of rest. Darmon is not the only French Jew drawing this conclusion, and not just because of the weather. For the living and the dead here, Israel is becoming the final destination. Some are snapping up cemetery plots in the Holy Land early on as insurance against premature death and sharply rising prices. Others are unearthing loved ones from French graveyards for reburial in Israel, sometimes years after their death. Their decisions are being shaped by a confluence of religious, financial, and practical considerations.
Mais grosso modo, le pourcentage, je pense que c'est 1 sur 3. En ce moment, à peu près. Après, il y a aussi les personnes,
Darmon, who manages a funeral home in northeastern Paris, is seeing the changes in his books. Roughly a third of his business heads to Israel. There are others who would like to be buried there, but can't afford it. Just how many Jews end up in Israel is hard to say. Israeli airline El Al, which carries the caskets, will not disclose the figures. Undertakers, along with the Paris Consistory, representing the Jewish community here, say the numbers are growing steadily and amount to hundreds each year. They reflect Israel's larger pull for French Jews, who are immigrating there by the thousands for religious and emotional reasons. For Ariel Kandel, who heads the Paris office of the Jewish Agency for Israel, it makes more sense for Jews to head to the Holy Land alive.
Israel s'est pas fait pour être enterré. Israel s'est fait pour vivre et pour construire le pays et pour.
The point of Israel, he says, isn't to get buried there, but to live there and build the country. It's something positive. But these days, burial decisions are being driven by necessity as well as by choice. Jewish-only sections in some cemeteries around Paris, where most French Jews live, are filling up. That's true for celebrated cemeteries like Père Lachaise. And for the area's largest cemetery in the French suburb of Pantin.
Parler, il faut savoir que donc au cimetière, notamment au cimetière parisien de Pantin.
Now Darmon says cemeteries are beginning to have mixed faith plots. So those who are scrupulous about Jewish laws prefer to be buried in Israel. Others are finding that family burial plots are not forever in France. Many have fixed-term leases that are rapidly running out. And authorities can exhume and burn the remains of untended graves, a practice that goes against Jewish beliefs. That, says Orthodox Rabbi Mendel Asimov, is scaring many French Jews.
Burial is not a lifetime. Burial could be one day thrown out from the cave. So there's every day there's dead people that are carried over for burial to Israel. My grandparents themselves were buried in Israel. My mother myself was buried in Israel. So every day, whoever has the possibility financially, which costs a lot more, to send over. So every night, a 10:30 flight, El Al has a few bodies going to Israel.
Funeral homes are quickly responding to this new reality. Across town, undertaker Menachem Perez says his funeral home, Sportes, has bought up 100 plots at a cemetery near Jerusalem. Sportes ships about 130 caskets to Israel yearly, including exhumed bodies for reburial there.
On arrive à 12 000 euros, à 2 000 euros de plus. Une personne peut être enterrée en Israël. Alors bien sûr, il y a des frais de voyage qui sont à compter en plus. Mais des fois, les gens savent que, de toute façon, les frais...
Burial in Israel is a few thousand more euros, Perez says, but it's worth it, because Israel is forever. With less red tape and daily El Al flights from Paris, it's also much easier and quicker to be buried there than a decade ago. Perez heads to his next assignment at a hospital outside the capital. Family and friends crowd around a casket set out in a small room. Men chant passages from the Torah. An old woman cries in a corner. A policeman seals the coffin before it's lowered into a waiting van. The door snaps shut and the body is gone, on its way to Israel and sunshine. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is Women's History Month, and one organization stressing the importance of female contributions around the world is the Peace Corps. Their volunteers are working to increase opportunities for women and girls. We spoke about the issue with Megan Donahue, the gender programming and training specialist with the Corps.
The situation is different in every country, and that's what we train volunteers. Every volunteer receives training in gender equality and women's empowerment. And what that does is it introduces them to the differences between gender and sex. So gender, meaning it's a social construction, and therefore it's dynamic and can change, and sex, which is a biological difference. So we see what is that gender definition in the particular country in which volunteers work, and then they look at different scenarios to see what were the gender issues that came out of those scenarios, and then what were the gaps and how you can address it. We begin like that. Then once they get into their communities, they will go through a similar process, but it's live now, right? They're working with community members. And then we hope that they have acquired a gender lens and are able to see what is preventing women and girls and boys and men, perhaps, from participating fully. That could be education, it could be farming, it can be an environment or health or youth. Any situation that would not allow them to participate fully. And then the volunteers work with their community members to find a solution. Like, how can we fill that gap? You know, to first express, to ask questions about why this is happening, and then how could we solve an issue? I'm saying to you very, very quickly, but it's a slow process.
Is this just concerning employment, or are there other areas as well?
No, it can be education. Why aren't girls going to school? And even if they are in school, why are girls not participating? Why aren't they raising their hands? Why are there more male teachers than female teachers? Who are making decisions in the community? In the household level, who's receiving the little bit of funding that exists? Who gets the best food in the family? You know, it can be a number of things that don't have to do with employment, but obviously employment is the most visible.
Do you feel this is a major problem around the world, getting women equal to men or girls and boys?
Oh, yeah, around the world. You know, I emphasize that.
Could you describe a little bit what the situation is like? How bad is it?
It can be bad in terms of just girls realizing that they can't go to school or not knowing what their opportunities exist for them. So I think what is worse is when you know there are many opportunities, but you know you can't have access to them. That's the worst, right? Or if you want to be a farmer, but you don't have access to seeds or a voice at meetings or decision-making or what kind of crops to grow that would give you more time or time to even show up at meetings. So it can be as bad as just being completely left out. That's the worst. And then it can be worse if you don't have the tools to even be there and participate.
The Peace Corps has stressed the importance of the role of women in society. Perhaps you could remind us of that lesson.
Well, the importance is what we do is we say all community members participate. And if all community members, we know that if more women participate, that it is economically more viable, that you will increase your GDP. You know, we will give them the bigger picture opportunities and benefits that will happen if more women and girls participate. And if they don't, then it just is just the opposite. You will not have the economic development that you really want. So you have to sort of present it like that. Like, this is what will happen if more women and girls are included, then this will happen. You have to try to present them in that way.
If you could tell our listeners one thing about this issue, what would it be?
One thing that I would just say is that to begin young, you know, to give girls and boys messages through that they can be in a world that gives them equal opportunity, like that will allow them to participate on a level playing field.
Megan Donahue, Gender Programming and Training Specialist in the Peace Corps. Well, thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 10th, 241 BC, the first of three conflicts between Rome and Carthage was decided in a naval battle off the west coast of Sicily. The Roman fleet scored a victory, leading to a Carthaginian surrender in the first of the so-called Punic Wars. On this date in 1804, the American flag was raised on day two of the Three Flags ceremony in St. Louis. This happened after the French and Spanish flags had been lowered. The ceremony marked the turning over of the Louisiana Purchase, more than 2 million square kilometers of territory, to the United States. In 1831, the French Foreign Legion was created. The Legion was an all-volunteer force that once attracted mostly foreigners, troublemakers, and outcasts. Commanded by French officers, the Legion has seen combat in regional and world wars. In 1848, the U.S. Senate ratified the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, ending the three-year war between the United States and Mexico. With the defeat of its army and the fall of its capital, Mexico ceded territory, now covering some or all of the U.S. states of Arizona, New Mexico, California, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado. In 1906, Europe's worst mining accident occurred in northern France. A coal dust explosion took the lives of more than 1,000 men. On this day in 1910, slavery was officially abolished in China. On this day in 1913, abolitionist Harriet Tubman died. Over the course of 10 years, Tubman, a runaway slave, would lead hundreds of other slaves to freedom along the so-called Underground Railroad, a secret network of safe houses. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Some of the world's busiest shipping lanes trace along the northwestern Arabian Sea, where it laps the Horn of Africa and narrows toward the Gulf of Aden. Since the second phase of the Somali Civil War began around 2005, this area has been teeming with pirates. In 2008 alone, pirates launched 111 attacks on ships, 42 of which succeeded. The ships and their crews were hijacked and held for ransom. The pirates upped the ante in 2009. The rate of attacks increased tenfold in January and February of that year, as compared to the same period in 2008. Seeking to stop the hijackings, the international community established in January 2009 the Contact Group on Piracy off of the coast of Somalia. This diverse group brought together numerous countries, international and non-governmental organizations, to coordinate their efforts to counter piracy off the Horn of Africa. Since then, the Contact Group has grown to an open and vital architecture of 80 nations and organizations, including the entire spectrum of stakeholders, different ministries, international and non-governmental organizations, many sectors of the maritime industry, and representatives of civil society, said Donna Hopkins, U.S. State Department Coordinator for Counterpiracy and Maritime Security. The figures speak for themselves. There has been no piracy hijacking off the coast of Somalia since May 10, 2012, over 20 months. This is the lowest rate of attempted hijackings in over 6 years, and certainly since the peak of the crisis in 2011. This remarkable turn of events is due not only to the multinational counter-piracy operations preventing and disrupting pirate attacks, but also because commercial ships are helping by protecting themselves, including the use of armed security teams. Nonetheless, though the situation has improved, passage through the area is still dangerous. The group continues to prevent pirate attacks at sea, but it also works to undermine support for the pirates on shore and works with the Somali government to offer alternative employment to would-be pirates. This is an international law enforcement effort to bring to justice the handful of kingpins who operate this terrible enterprise, said Donna Hopkins. The fundamental conditions along the Somali coast have not yet changed, and if we drop our guard, piracy will return.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.